Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, May 9th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Elections in Wisconsin, Indiana, and North Carolina. Activists target Bank of America ahead of their shareholders meeting, and a people's guide to Los Angeles. Plus this week's activist beat. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Today is Wednesday. Voters in Wisconsin yesterday chose Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett to run against incumbent Governor Scott Walker in the June 5th gubernatorial recall election. Barrett easily beat his opponents, winning 56 out of 72 Wisconsin counties. The embattled Governor Walker, who in facing a recall has to fight to keep his job, easily beat his GOP opponent in yesterday's primary, but fell short of garnering as many votes overall compared to the combined Democratic vote. On June 5th, it is assumed that most, if not all, those who voted in the Democratic primary will vote for Barrett to replace Walker. In Indiana, veteran GOP Senator Dick Lugar lost his re-election bid by a landslide. He was beaten by Richard Murdoch, whom the Christian Science Monitor referred to as a Harley-riding Tea Party hardliner. Lugar's loss is being explained in part by a complacency he developed toward his home base after six terms as a veteran senator. However, it's also an indicator of the reemergence of the Tea Party. Even though Lugar outspent Murdoch by a 3-1 margin, Murdoch was backed by the NRA and such right-wing organizations as Freedom Works and the Club for Growth. Meanwhile, voters in North Carolina passed a constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage in a preemptive bid to ward off legal challenges to their existing marriage ban. Tammy Fitzgerald, chairwoman of the group backing the measure, justified the vote, saying, quote, "The point is that you don't rewrite the nature of God's design for marriage based on the demands of a group of adults." And in West Virginia, presidential candidate Mitt Romney easily won his primary election with nearly 70% in a field of five candidates. Interestingly, President Obama faced a Democratic challenger in West Virginia by an inmate serving 17 and a half years for extortion. The president won 59-41%. Romney, who is considered the de facto Republican nominee, also won primaries in Indiana and North Carolina. My guest is John Nichols, associate editor for the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressives, co-founder of Free Press, author of many books. His latest is called Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Welcome back to Uprising, John.
It's great to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's go in order. Let's start with your home state of Wisconsin. The election that happened yesterday is a primary leading up to the general election on June 5th and was the latest in the series of elections that began going all the way back to the uprising that you describe in your book, where Scott Walker is essentially facing blowback for his anti-labor actions, right?
Yeah, it's a really remarkable moment when you think about it, because we have such high political intensity in Wisconsin right now that though this was a primary election, the turnout was the highest that the state has seen in a primary since 1952 when Joe McCarthy was on the ballot.
Wow. So who is Tom Barrett?
Well, Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee, and that's the state's largest city. Prior to being mayor of Milwaukee, he was a state representative and a member of Congress. When he served in Congress, he was one of the handful of members of Congress who voted against deregulation of Wall Street in the late 1990s. He opposed the NAFTA and China free trade deals. He also opposed U.S. entry into the WTO. He was one of the small number of members of Congress who voted with Russ Feingold against the USA Patriot Act in 2001, and he was a leading opponent of authorizing George Bush to go to war in Iraq. And so it's pretty fair to say that he is one of the more progressive folks. He was one of the more progressive folks in Congress when he was there, and he is a very progressive candidate for governor.
So it looks as though on June 5th, if everybody who voted for Democrats in this high turnout primary race yesterday show up on June 5th, they may be likely to get Tom Barrett into the gubernatorial office and oust Walker.
Well, it's within the realm of reason. I mean, I think that we have to be careful on that, though. The first thing to be conscious of is that, yes, if the universe of people who voted yesterday come out and vote on June 5th, Tom Barrett will win because a lot more people voted, a significant number of more people voted for the Democratic candidates, all of whom are very united in their opposition to Walker. And there was actually 20,000 votes cast in the Republican primary against Walker for a protest candidate who is very much on the left. And so, yeah, the numbers are good there, but you have to understand there was a 30% of the electorate came out and voted in this primary. I expect that the general election turnout will be closer to 60 to 70% of the electorate, so we'll have a doubling of the number of people who come. And really what you're going to see is that Wisconsin is an intensely divided state, as intensely divided as any state in the U.S. Pollsters tell us this, pundits do. There's a general agreement that there's no state in the country today that is so highly mobilized and energized politically and so closely divided. And so what's really going to happen in the next 27 days, and it's going to be a remarkable period in American history, is going to be one of the most intense efforts you've ever seen on the part of both sides to get their voters out. Critical to this process is going to be something that Democrats are sometimes good at, sometimes bad at, and that is mobilizing low-income people of color, and especially women. And in this case, looking especially at single moms, younger women, folks who often have a lot of things going on in their lives. They're not always the first people at the polls.
Right.
But you have to get, you have to expand the electorate to include, again, low-income folks, people of color, especially younger women. If that happens, if you have that high level of mobilization, then there's no question Scott Walker loses. But if the electorate gets older and whiter and more upper income, you know, where those proportions go will really decide how this thing turns out.
Let's talk about Indiana. Senator Dick Lugar has lost his seat in Senate after six terms, and his opponent is a, as I quoted the Christian Science Monitor, a Tea Party hardliner. Actually, they called him a Harley Riding Tea Party hardliner. What does this mean? And what is it, first of all, what will the impact of this election be in Congress?
Well, it's a huge, huge result. This is an election result that ought to be seen as having sort of the highest level of significance, even up there, very close to presidential level. And it's for this reason. Dick Lugar was the last of the truly bipartisan Republicans on foreign policy. And I've covered him for the better part of 20 years. He was a conservative. It's very, people call him a moderate. He wasn't a moderate. He was a genuinely conservative Republican, but he was rational and he had a heart. And so when issues of famine in Africa came up, instability in southern Asia, challenges around the world, he was the guy that the Democrats and you know, people of goodwill would go to and say, we need you. And whether Democrats were in charge of the Senate or Republicans, Lugar would be there. And on issues like nuclear disarmament, he was an absolutely central figure. So his loss to the Senate, his loss to the Senate means that, you know, a historical era has ended, an era in which you had Republicans who might be very, very conservative on domestic issues, but when you got to the borders of the United States, they became rational players. That's done. And people ought to recognize it is a very, very big deal for our relations with Africa, with Asia, with parts of the world, that, you know, you have a very reactionary Republican caucus in the Senate. Things are going to get tougher. So his loss is a big deal. It's also a big deal for the Republican Party, because it truly shows that the party is moving toward this purist position that may make it possible. It may make it possible that a Democrat could win the Indiana seat, just as in Delaware in 2010, when a Tea Party candidate beat a much stronger Republican candidate, the Democrats won that seat. So that's possible. But people should take their partisan hat off, at least for a second, and recognize that while this might be good in this election year for Democrats, it is a destabilizing development as regards the Senate and foreign policy.
Let's talk about
much harder to get bipartisan consensus.
Let's go to North Carolina, where there was a constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage that passed. This is a state that already had a marriage ban, a same-sex marriage ban. Does what happened in North Carolina represent the reactionary right-wing forces that have been passing these bans all over the country, that represent a sort of more offensive position than they already had?
Not really. I mean, what you're seeing is sort of like double, triple secret, you know, ban kind of stuff. It's sort of, you know, the Department of Redundancy Department here. And I don't mean to make light of it. It's ugly, and it's done for political purposes. These bans aren't about concerns about legal fights or things of that nature. What they're really about is mobilizing a Christian conservative, social conservative base, and, frankly, about trying to divide some Democratic constituencies to get some more socially conservative Democrats to be frustrated with or ill at ease with their party. But this is a purely political gesture that has, unfortunately, tragically, a very crude and dark component as regards what it says to you know, same-sex couples, same-sex families, and it's especially tragic in North Carolina, because while North Carolina has some very, very conservative areas, understand, North Carolina is a state with a great deal of high-tech development, many, many great universities. You've got college towns. There are a lot of gays and lesbians. LGBT communities are very present in North Carolina. And they've just been battered, frankly.
Well, apparently this constitutional amendment, at least according to the LA Times, may threaten domestic partnership health benefits for local government workers, and it could strip unmarried couples, both gay and straight, of certain rights.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt of that. And you shouldn't, you know, undermine or be dismissive of that. It can have it, although intriguingly enough, around the country, as amendments like this have been passed, legal challenges brought by the Lambda Legal Defense Fund and other groupings have sometimes had a good deal of success in defending domestic partnership benefits on the argument that they are not marriage. I mean, they are in fact different.
Interesting.
And so it is. We still have a great legal battle to be fought in North Carolina and other states. But you're right. I mean, this is ugly stuff, and it is intriguingly enough, many of these laws and many of these initiatives are as damaging to straight couples as to gay and lesbian community folks, because there are many straight couples who rely on domestic partnership benefits to get health care and things of that nature.
Finally, John, I can't help but ask you about a race that, well, Fox News is making a really big deal of, that President Obama faced a Democratic challenger in West Virginia, which is a red state and so not necessarily in play in the presidential election. But he faced a challenge from Keith Judd, an inmate serving a number of years for extortion. The president did win. I don't think he campaigned, though. 59% to 41%. Any thoughts?
Look, this is a game that we all play, and we all like to write we cover politics, like to write these kind of oddball articles. The fact of the matter is that something you have to put in the mix on elections of this kind. When you have a presidential primary, which is very, very low profile, parallel to local and state elections, which they had primaries in West Virginia for every mm-hmm. other office. You got people coming out to vote for county sheriff, for state representative, things of that nature. And voting in that presidential primary becomes a very, very different factor as a result. What I would tell you is if somebody wants to focus on the West Virginia result, that's fine. You could do that. But then the parallel is to focus on North Carolina, where President Obama got 125,000 more votes yesterday than Mitt Romney. And so you can always find, you can find these anomalies, but they're not rooted in actual turnout as regards the presidential race. They are rooted in local factors that bring people out.
Well, John Nichols, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Sonali, always.
John Nichols is associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. He's a correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing editor for The Progressive, co-founder of Free Press, author of many books. His latest is called Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. You can listen to the entire hour-long interview I did with him about that book on our website, uprisingradio.org. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at the actions happening around the country, including here in Southern California. They actually happened yesterday ahead of the Bank of America shareholders meeting. And we'll also hear this week's activist beat. Finally, a people's guide to Los Angeles. We'll take a look at an unconventional local guidebook. Stay tuned.
Bibliocracy, biblio, book, crassy, rule, where books rule.
The ink is black, the page is white.
Like my theme song, The Ink is Black, The Page is White, together we learn to read and write. Fiction, nonfiction, poetry, I share the best of what I read. Writers you know, some you should. The words stand out so clear and bright. Wednesday nights at 8, Bibliocracy on KPFK.
Samar by The Clouds from Jakarta. Check uprisingradio.org for more information under our featured music section. This is Uprising, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Hundreds of protesters rallied outside the Bank of America shareholders meeting today in Charlotte, North Carolina, to protest the financial institution that is central to the housing and foreclosure crisis. BFA shareholders are reportedly going to introduce a resolution to end political spending by the bank, following a similar action by shareholders of U.S. manufacturer 3M. Public Citizen reports this would cover contributions to the American Legislative Exchange Council, to super PACs during this election cycle, and to the pro-corporate anti-tax U.S. Chamber of Commerce. A similar resolution was not approved by 3M shareholders at their annual meeting yesterday in St. Paul, Minnesota. Protests were held at Bank of America branches yesterday in many cities in advance of today's shareholder meetings, including in New York City and Detroit. In Los Angeles, Occupy foreclosure activists staged a fraudulent foreclosure at the home of a Bank of America executive in Pasadena to draw attention to the plight of one L.A. family fighting foreclosure. Derma Rodriguez is a mother of five children, including one severely disabled daughter. She and her supporters say BFA fraudulently foreclosed on her after approving her mortgage modification. Activists estimate the bank may have financially benefited from the foreclosure by as much as $1.5 million by earning a tax write-off after foreclosure, receiving a mortgage insurance payment on the unpaid loan, and by selling the home to Westridge Rentals for over $300,000. Bank of America yesterday announced it would offer principal reduction to 200,000 homeowners as part of the $25 billion settlement that five banks reached with 49 state attorneys general earlier this year. Joining me in studio this morning is Suzanne O'Keefe. She is a writer, filmmaker, web developer, and an activist with Occupy Fights Foreclosure. Welcome to Uprising, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first tell us what happened yesterday in Pasadena, as well as in some other cities around the country that you know of, but particularly in Pasadena.
Well, it was a very well thought through action. We wanted to really bring home the message that a lot of these shareholders that are ignoring and B of A is ignoring the families when they're making these decisions. They're looking at the bottom line, and we wanted to bring face-to-face, put a face on the foreclosure issue. And so we had one of the families that had been fraudulently foreclosed by B of A that we are working with, Derma Rodriguez and her family came to fraudulently foreclose on an executive's house because a lot of these foreclosures that are going on are not they don't have standing to foreclose on them. The banks don't have standing to foreclose on these properties, or they have fraudulently done the foreclosures themselves.
So Derma got a loan modification from Bank of America for her home.
Yes.
And then they decided to foreclose on her.
Yes. In fact, one of the pieces of evidence we showed yesterday was the letter from B of A, which is dated March 30th, 2010, approving her for a loan mod and with the amount and everything in it. And then less than 30 days later, they submitted a notice of sale, notice of trustee sale, which means we are going to sell your house anyway.
So she didn't miss any payments. She just went through the procedure in good faith to modify her loan so that she could afford to pay it, but then just simply faced foreclosure because Bank of America decided maybe that it was going to be more money for them up front?
Right. Well, there's many reasons why they're foreclosing. One of them being that they need these houses back to correct their books, I believe. But the other way is that they are just making there's a lot of money that people don't realize that is coming from the foreclosures, and it's more profitable for them than to renegotiate. They've made so much money on these loans that it's not good to change them so that, you know, the whole chain that is dependent on these loans will have to change.
So instead of basically modifying the loan so that it can be afforded by the homeowner, they can put it up for auction and get cash up front from a developer that can afford to pay $300,000 up front and then rent it to a family.
Right. There's a lot of scams going on and a lot of predatory things going on that investors are going in and buying up foreclosed homes without caring whether or not they were legal.
I mean, it's amazing. I'm looking at this letter that you showed me to Derma Rodriguez from Bank of America. And in the letter, they say, we want to help you stay in your home. And under the federal government's home affordable modification program, we may be able to provide a more affordable mortgage payment. And so they then ask her to make the first month's trial period mortgage payment of $2,600, etc. So they give her instructions on how to proceed with this new program, and then they decide to foreclose.
Well, she paid right away, and they put a notice for sale, which makes no sense, within 30 days. And then she continued to pay those amounts, and they cashed her checks. This is for almost a year, and then they just sold her house.
This letter is dated March 30th, 2010.
Right.
So she continued to make payments toward what she thought was a modified loan for a year.
Right. And then they sold it out from under her in September of 2011.
How can they get away with this?
Because people don't realize. I think part of the reason is people are blaming the homeowner for the situations that they're in, not realizing that fraud was a business model, that these banks set up this as a business model. It made them much profits. It made the executives much, much money, billions of dollars. And not all the banks you know, were doing this, mostly the big banks and unscrupulous banks. But there was a lot of money to be made, and that's what they did. Fraud is a business model.
So Derma Rodriguez and her family were present at the action yesterday?
Yes, they were there. Can you name the executive? The executive's name was Raul Anaya, who is a new B of A executive. He just recently got the job, and he's head of corporate responsibility. So we thought that was an appropriate person.
And so he has a fancy home in Pasadena?
It was a lovely home. It's not a huge mansion. It's not, you know, a gated community. It's a lovely neighborhood, quiet neighborhood in
Pasadena. And he doesn't face a danger of foreclosure.
Yes. One of the things we said yesterday was the only ones that are breaking any laws here are the bankers, but no police are knocking down their doors in the middle of the night.
Suzanne O'Keefe, so people had been confronting Bank of America branches and executives across the country. I mentioned New York and Detroit, and there's a shareholders meeting happening today. So what are the plans for that meeting?
I know there's been a lot of protests, which you mentioned, planned for today. And there's also a shareholders revolt that's going on that are one of the things they were trying to force. The shareholders themselves are trying to force a review to their foreclosure proceedings and processes. So that's a very good sign that
shareholders... And is that being done independently?
Or? Independently, yeah. Mm-hmm. The shareholders just realized, a lot of them are realizing that there's a lot of fraud going on, and they're investing in a lot of fraud unless they stop the company from continuing these.
So it's not necessarily coming out of the goodness of their heart. They just don't want to lose money if Bank of America does get federally prosecuted.
That's probably true. And I mean, self-interest is there. But there's also, I think, a realization that there's no future in fraud. So they want the company to change its policies.
You could fit that on a sign. Suzanne O'Keefe, how is it that these actions that Bank of America and other banks are engaged in, how is it that they're getting away with it? Are they technically legal? Are they just sort of skirting the law? Or are they flatly illegal?
There's lots that are flatly illegal. I mean, we set up a few examples. Some of them are procedurally illegal, like they don't do the proper processes that are required by law, the amount of time that people need to respond to things. They just neglect those laws all the time. Mm-hmm. But there's also real fraud where they recreate documents out of thin air.
Wow.
Because they've already destroyed the documents from the origination fraud. Like the mortgage fraud in the beginning was fraudulent because the appraisers themselves were leaned on by the banks to inflate appraisals. So the amount of money that you would need for a loan would be higher, so the banks would make more money, and they would give you loans that were higher rates, even though you qualified for lower rates because the banks made more money. So this is the kind of fraud that went on from the beginning of the loan. And people are just not aware because it's been suppressed in the media. It's been diverted by too much. The banks want us to shame the homeowner instead.
Finally, how can people get involved in some of the actions? Occupy fights foreclosure activists have been trying to get folks into their homes. And also maybe you should begin by telling us what's the status of Derma Rodriguez and her family.
Well, they are in the home, and Bank of America has said they are willing to take the house back from Westside Rentals, which is the
And you think this happened
house
as a result of the public pressure?
Yes, the public pressure has had a big effect, actually. So that is important to keep up the public pressure on B of A and other big banks that are doing the same exact thing. That's why we're doing what we're doing. And we're hoping to further investigate her loans. That's what we're doing next, is to forensically audit her loan and also audit the securitization so we know whether B of A has any standing at all in the house anymore.
She may be able to keep her home, is what you're saying, as a result of this action. One of the things we didn't get to talk about was the insurance payments on the unpaid loan that Bank of America gets. So it's in their interest to not have the mortgage paid. So this seems like another whole incentive to have these kinds of incidents continue.
Right. A lot of people don't realize the banks are dual tracking them. They'll tell them that they're going to modify their loans, but in the meantime, they're proceeding on the foreclosure because at 90 days, they get an insurance payment.
Mm-hmm.
So the people are told to default for 3 months so that they get the banks get the house insurance payment.
Finally, where can listeners find out more about the work that you and other activists are doing? How can they get involved with Occupy Fights for Foreclosure?
We do have a website, OccupyFightsForeclosures.org. We also have a phone number you can call. It's 310-912-3494. We're nonprofit, of course, and or we're not even nonprofit. We're just a bunch of activists, volunteers. So it's all volunteers, mm-hmm. all people coming together, doing what they're doing because we think that it's important. And the one of the ways we can also get involved is I know Bank of America is ramping up to foreclose on 10,000 homes a day, and so 10,000 people can transfer their money out of the banks into credit unions, a day. Well, let's do that instead.
OccupyFightsForeclosures.org is a website. Suzanne O'Keefe is my guest. Thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you so much, very much.
This is Uprising, and up next we'll hear this week's Activist Beat and then A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Stay tuned.
I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW in San Francisco with this week's Activist Beat for Uprising. Each week, I'll bring you a weekly roundup of progressive activism that the mainstream media ignores, undercovers, or misrepresents. A few days ago, Uprising reported on the Palestinian prisoners who began their fourth week of hunger strikes to protest abusive and substandard conditions in Israeli jails. Well, here in the United States, citizens are using the same method to get their messages across. And like the Palestinian prisoners, they're not receiving the media coverage they deserve. I don't expect protests and rallies to get much media attention, but hunger strikes in the United States? At the Ohio State Penitentiary, at least 25 inmates who are locked in their cells for 23 hours a day began their second week of refusing to eat. They want more recreation and out-of-cell time, programs to teach them trades, and help them cope with sensory deprivation. They also want a transparent security-level classification process. According to the Vindicator newspaper, Donald Brown has not eaten since April 30th. He's serving 30 years for a series of burglary, theft, and escape charges, and he spends 23 hours a day in his cell. These inmates held a 3-day hunger strike back in February in solidarity with the Occupy for Prisoners actions. And here in California, 12 college students at 6 state campuses are on a juice fast to protest rising tuition, presidential pay raises, and next year's possible enrollment freeze. If California voters do not approve the tax measure on the November ballot, there's a strong likelihood that state schools will not accept new students next year. What message does this send to the next generation? These students have 4 demands. Create a 5-year freeze on tuition increases, eliminate all housing and car allowances for all 23 campus presidents, roll back executive salaries to 1999 levels, and free speech rights on all campuses. Chancellor Charles Reed, who recently met with the students, told them their demands are not possible. Instead of focusing on the executives, he said they should be focusing on the government. In other words, this is out of my hands. Good luck. Cal State Fullerton history graduate student David Inga told the Daily Titan that they plan to continue their hunger strike until their demands are met. So far, the New York Times, the LA Times, and local papers have covered the strike. And then there's Donna Vieira, a 42-year-old mom. She started her second hunger strike outside the San Francisco offices of California Attorney General Kamala Harris on Monday. This is her second hunger strike. Last month, she didn't eat for 16 days, and yet she's only been interviewed once by a Spanish-language television channel. I spoke to her on Monday. She said she decided to start another hunger strike because we can't wait for politicians to make more promises. We need real action now. She and her husband were foreclosed on by Wells Fargo. She says it's been a 6-year nightmare. Donna has spent 4 of those years in court demanding that Wells Fargo disclose the list of investors who own her mortgage loan, but the company has refused to comply. I've become used to the media ignoring protests and sit-ins, but it's very strange to see them ignore a hunger strike. How can reporters ignore a 42-year-old mom on hunger strike? College students and Donna Vieira realize that holding signs and marching is not enough. Desperate times call for desperate measures. These citizens are refusing to eat because they want to be heard. Now, it's easy to ignore protests, but it's not as easy to ignore people who refuse to eat. But based on the lack of media coverage thus far, it looks like these hunger strikers will have to get seriously sick before they're taken seriously. And this speaks volumes about the current state of affairs in this country. Find out how you can support these hunger strikers at uprisingradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar for Uprising.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa this week requested the city council vote on an ordinance banning tents from all public parks. The ordinance is based on an existing law that disallows camping in parks, but is widely seen as an attempt to prevent a new Occupy LA encampment on the city lawn. Groups advocating for the city's homeless are outraged, saying it is part of the mayor's, quote, continuing criminalization of the poor and protesters. Such laws and ordinances, policies and practices that shape the political geography of Los Angeles are often lost to history. While tourists and even many Angelenos conjure the Hollywood Boulevard or Olvera Street as best representing the city's significance, there are countless street corners, buildings, parks, and other spaces whose cultural and political history is part of LA's fabric, but are in danger of being obscured by the glamour and glitz that conventional guidebooks direct tourists towards. Now, a new book called A People's Guide to Los Angeles, written by Laura Pulido, Laura Balaclav, and Wendy Cheng, attempts to document those obscure and intimate histories. The authors, quote, show how everyday people are exploited and disenfranchised by capital and the state, how those same people sometimes mobilize to create alternative forms of power, how racism, sexism, class differences, and homophobia lead to conflict and struggle, how dominant ideas are memorialized in landscapes, and how Los Angeles has been a constant site of struggle between nature and people. Laura Pulido and Wendy Cheng, two of the co-authors, now join me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Pulido, you are a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, currently a visiting professor in Black Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. And Wendy Cheng, you're an assistant professor of Asian Pacific American Studies and Justice and Social Inquiry at Arizona State University. I should mention, Laura, you've also written a book, Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left, Radical Activism in Los Angeles. So you're certainly not, you're a veteran, if you will, of studying Los Angeles. First, explain why you decided to write this kind of a book chock full of the history and cultural aspects of Los Angeles in the form of a guidebook.
Well, that was not our original intention. when we first decided, I had been researching actually the previous book that you mentioned, and I had encountered many interesting places, and I was collecting them. And then a friend of mine, Tony Osumi, said, well, why don't you put them together and call it A People's Guide to L.A.? And I really liked that idea, and I started working on it. But for many years, I was searching for the right kind of format. And initially, I was very drawn to the idea of like a coffee table book. And I imagined, you know, lots of white space, beautiful photographs, kind of documenting these oppositional sites. But when we talked to editors and presses about it, they said, no, make it a tour guide. And the thinking there is that if you really want to get people to go to those places, you have to kind of put it on a map and make it very clear to people how to do that. And so we struggled with that for a while, but eventually we saw they really were right, and that was the right path to go. But it did require a lot of rethinking and work on our part because we had never done a guidebook.
The guidebook not only has the actual spaces and, of course, the photographs, the parks and the buildings, but you have personal reflections by people who have lived the history of Los Angeles. How did you go about gathering those personal reflections, and why is that important, Wendy?
Well, I think the personal reflections also speak to our process of bringing the book together, which involves so many more people than just the three of us. And so the way we built the knowledge in the book was by tapping networks, people that we knew, people we might have organized campaigns with, people that were personal friends who really led us to many of these sites. So the personal reflections are just a slice of how the book actually came to be, you know, in these sort of everyday knowledges that people have about the spaces that they occupy, and trying to bring those to the forefront as important to the history of the city.
Mm. But you also throw in your favorite restaurants. And how did you divide up the city? Start out talking about North Los Angeles, which is not actually a recognized part of the city. We talk about South LA, we talk about downtown, the West Side, but we don't really say North LA.
No, it's a geographic region we created. And the idea there, when you actually put all these sites on a map, there's a very clear clustering around what might be called downtown, midtown Los Angeles, mid-city area, places we all know. But we had to create, I think we create seven zones for LA County. So we have the San Fernando Valley, West Side, and so on. But if you think about this area that is like downtown, mid-city area, north of that, there's no unifying term. And so we want to kind of juxtapose that with South LA or South Central LA, as it used to formerly be called, because that's become such a racialized site. You know, you say that word and a certain set of images, territory, people come to mind in very racialized
tourist buses tourists. Don't stop there.
Absolutely not. So we just wanted to, you know, race is such a spatialized kind of process. And so we kind of wanted to play on that and bring that out for people to begin thinking about, well, if there is this thing called, you know, North LA that we're making up, well, where does that come from? And what kind of work does that do, especially in relationship to other places like East LA, South LA?
Hmm. Let's talk about some of the places that you focus on in your book. We were just talking earlier with a woman who's an activist working on ending foreclosures in Southern California. Well, losing homes is not a new crisis in Southern California. And you have a section in your book as part of the North Los Angeles section on Chavez Ravine, which to longtime Angelenos is a familiar word, but maybe for new implants, something that they don't really know about. And they know Dodger Stadium, but they don't know that history of people being kicked out of their homes. And you have these dramatic photos of women and children and families being pulled out of their homes. Tell us a little bit about that history and how you sort of express it in this guidebook.
Can we do that?
go ahead, Laura.
You know, you're right. Chavez Ravine is kind of like this legendary thing. And so we debated, actually, well, should we include it because it's so well known? But on the other hand, that's an important part of a city, is its memories, its history, and its legends. So we thought it was really important to include it. And what happened at Chavez Ravine, it refers to a series of communities just north of downtown. They were primarily Mexicano rural communities. And they were declared to be blighted in the 1940s. And this was a time when Los Angeles was having a real serious housing crisis. And so the idea was they were going to be blighted, dozed, and then public housing was going to be built in those sites. Well, that public housing was never built because at the time, this is the moment of the Red Scare. And there was people called this an example of creeping socialism. A lot of landlord organizations got together to fight it, this kind of public ownership. So as a result, the people were kicked out, they were dozed out, the entire communities were dozed down, and there was no public housing built. But you have this land then that's all kind of been prepped, if you will, for development. And along come then the Dodgers from Brooklyn wanting to relocate. And so pretty much they picked up this land for a song, as much of the work had been done at public expense. So a lot of times people think that the Dodgers kicked out the people. That's not what happened. It was done by the city to create public housing, but that never happened.
Another aspect to your book is you draw attention to those spaces of exclusion historically that it excluded folks, whether they were poor folks or people of color, in certain parts of LA. The California Club is one that you talk about. Interestingly enough, San Marino's Lacey Park is another one, which, you know, it's, living in Pasadena, I've been told by many of, you know, many moms that I know that it's a fantastic place to go, but you have to pay to go on the weekends. It's a public park. Tell us about some of these spaces.
Okay. Well, Lacey Park is a great example. I think also about how we try to make connections between privileged spaces and poor spaces, mm-hmm. and about how you can't really understand one of those without understanding the other side of it. So Lacey Park is a great example of what seems like an innocuous space, right? This beautiful park that was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted in one of the wealthiest communities in the United States. But what you see is all of these larger processes coming together, right? The defunding of parks in poorer areas and the concentration of resources in wealthier neighborhoods, and also the ability of those neighborhoods to control their space and who has access to that space by mandating fees for non-residents on the weekends, and also a permit system if you want to bring in a group larger than 15, which of course targets many poor people coming from surrounding areas who want to enjoy that space too. Mm-hmm. So I think in our book, we also have examples. You know, we have a lot of examples of how these processes are linked, right? So we don't have Florence and Normandy, for example, but we do have the site where Rodney King was pulled over and beaten up in the San Fernando Valley in Sylmar, right? And we have the...
And that's a forgotten space.
Right, yes. But it's so important that he was there, right, in this space that's been created out of exclusion and white privilege, and that's where that happened, right? So we think that those spaces are equally important to understanding rather than focusing on these areas of the city that are more typically considered sites of social unrest.
Mm. My guests are Wendy Chang and Laura Pulido. They are the co-authors of the new book, A People's Guide to Los Angeles, and they're going to be speaking about their book at a number of local events. They are going to be at the Autry in Griffith Park on Saturday, May 12th. That is 4700 Western Heritage Way. Romans on the 7th of June at 7 p.m. And then they're going to be at Skylight Books on the 11th of May at 7:30 p.m. And we'll put all of that information on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Let's go to East L.A. Again, our listeners who are in East L.A., these spaces may be nothing new to them, but those maybe on the West Side or in our Santa Barbara and San Diego listening areas may not know about Chuco's Justice Center and Free L.A. High School. They may not know about the sites of, you know, and of course in South L.A., actually Chuco's Justice Center is in South L.A., they may not know about many of these spaces. Tell us what you think our listeners should know about East L.A. first, and then we'll move on to South L.A.
Oh, wow. There's so much to
There's
know.
There's so much to know, yes.
Where does one begin?
Well, the Chicano moratorium happened in East L.A.
Absolutely. With the Chicano moratorium is known as the largest anti-war protest on the part of any community of color during the Vietnam War. And this was a very significant march. It was a march that activists organized. And they, I forget where they started, but they ended up over at Ruben Salazar Park.
What is now called Ruben
Salazar. It is now called, right, Ruben Salazar Park. And when they got to the park, that's when they were attacked by police. And it was a huge, an extreme example of police violence and unrest, where people were hospitalized and hurt. And for many Chicanos in particular, this was like their first experience of intense political protest and police backlash on that. Of course, individuals had been used to, police brutality, but not so much in this collective kind of sense in political protest. And so the name was then, so that first happened is all these people are attacked, brutally attacked. And then later on that day, the Mexican-American journalist, Ruben Salazar, he was covering the event, and then he went over to a bar to have a drink, I guess, after a long, hot day. It's August 31st, 1970. He went to the the Silver Dollar Cafe, and he gets shot then by a L.A. County sheriff. A projectile goes in and hits him in the head. Very recently, there was never any prosecution. Those records have been reviewed once again by Sheriff Baca. They decided, of course, that it was, you know, there was no fault on the part of the sheriff. There's no need for prosecution. So it was a couple of really important events which really mark these couple of sites. We put the sites actually together, I think, in the Guy the Park as well as the cafe where he was murdered at. And they're really important parts in terms of Chicano history as well as Los Angeles history also.
And then in South Los Angeles, one thing that stood out to me was the site of the former South Central Farm. And listeners to KPFK know very well this history, but anybody walking by the area where the South Central Farm stood who didn't know that history may not have known that it was the site of the largest urban garden, urban farm in the country, I believe, run primarily by immigrant workers. How do you document this history?
Well, I think that brings up a really important question in the guide and visually, you know, how we experience our everyday landscape. So if you go to the former site of the South Central Farm, you just see this vacant lot overgrown with weeds and a fence, right? So I think part of it is understanding how that space was the site of not just the South Central Farm, but also a successful struggle to defeat the placing of a toxic incinerator at that site, and then also a really key location in segregating South LA, right? With the Alameda Boulevard as this demarcation line between a white space and a black space. You know, so we try to make those histories come alive by putting that photograph of the vacant lot next to a photograph of a South Central farmer and to try to make people engage with that vacant lot in a way that they wouldn't necessarily without knowing, having that information all together in one place.
And so many of these histories have gotten erased by pressures of development, which is something that Los Angeles has a long, long struggle with. That continues to today. You know, tourists will stop by the LA Live complex in downtown LA, but they won't stop by the site of the former South Central Farm. How did you express those struggles over land that are so intimately connected with race and class and immigrant status in your guidebook, People's Guide to Los Angeles?
I guess we do it in a couple of ways. One, in the beginning of each chapter, we have kind of like a brief narrative that kind of introduces that part of Los Angeles. And so in several of those, we do try to talk about the importance of development and the tensions and struggles that arise from it. And really, when you think about really creating a guidebook of historic places as well as contemporary places in Los Angeles, you really have to deal very explicitly with development, because on the one hand, Los Angeles has this history of just continually dozing over its history, right? People say there's no history here, right? And they compare us like to other cities on the East Coast or something like that. And so there's a lot of truth to that. I don't want to pretend like there's not. On the other hand, that's not entirely true. There are a lot of our history is still there. It's evident. You oftentimes have to look with very different eyes to see it. And there also are lots of efforts, local, organic, indigenous efforts in Los Angeles to preserve that history. I mean, there's a whole cottage industry happening right now of efforts to preserve Los Angeles history, which is very, very exciting. So we see ourselves really kind of standing on the shoulders and kind of codifying what activists are doing right now in terms of providing local tours and things like that for J-Town, you know, Little Tokyo, for example, or something like that.
Mm. And you also have sections in your book on the harbor in South Bay where you look at the Port of LA and Liberty Hill. There's a history there with Upton Sinclair. There's, of course, the West Side, San Fernando Valley, North LA County. Listeners can get copies of the book. They're in bookstores now, and they can attend the events that the two of you are speaking at, Skylight Books on the 11th, Autry Museum on the 12th, Romans on the 7th of June. Finally, let me ask the two of you, how do you hope for this book to be used? I mean, do you expect tourists to pick it up, or is this meant for the activist? Because when I read it, to me, it's a great book for somebody new moving to LA who doesn't know the history, but who really wants to become not just engaged in their community, but maybe active in their community, because there's so many activist spaces that you also document.
I think think that's certainly one of our hoped for audiences. But I think we also hope that locals, people already living in LA, will pick it up and learn about their city in a different way or see things that have been important to them and their families reflected in this book. And we also think, we also hope that people will take it as a starting point to engage in these kinds of histories themselves, right? Think about, okay, what do I see around me and what would I think is a people's guide type of site? You know, so we really hope this way of thinking and engaging with the landscape and the world will spread, right? So, and that the book can serve as an entry point for that.
Mm-hmm. Are you taking input for a future edition?
Always, always. We hope to develop a web presence. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you know, one of the sad and painful things is just as the book was going to press, one of our sites closed down, mm-hmm. you know, so as soon as it comes out, it's dated. So we want to have a web presence so we can update it. People can send in their own ideas and submissions. People can react to some of the stuff that they see or experience when they go to some of these places as well.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, Laura Pulido and Wendy Cheng, two of the three authors of A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Pulido is a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. She's currently a visiting professor in Black Studies at UCSB. Wendy Cheng is an assistant professor of Asian Pacific American Studies and Justice and Social Inquiry at Arizona State University. And they're going to be speaking at a number of events and locations. Check uprisingradio.org for those details. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Howard Zinn said from A People's History of the United States, the memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. That's Howard Zinn. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews. You can also watch videos of our interviews. Rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook and Twitter, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.